The Road to Moscow by Robert Swipe. Part 11. Monday, October the 29th, 2007. Sunday, 28th of October, 2007. Liverpool 1, Arsenal 1. Sunday starts badly. I read two rejection emails.
Dear Robert Swipe, thank you for contacting Associates through our website and for posting an extract from your novel there. We were pleased to read and consider this, but have decided to pass on the opportunity of reading more material or representing this to UK publishers. Sorry to be negative, but we did not connect with the narrative voice as much as we'd need to in order to feel confident pitching this to publishers with their already crowded lists. All the best for finding an agent who feels differently. With best wishes.
I know you're not meant to take it personally and all that, but when you're writing as I am, you can't help but take things like that a little to heart. After all, that narrative voice they did not connect with is actually my voice. In fact, this voice you're hearing in your ears is not the figment of somebody's overactive imagination. It's actually me. Oh, and one last thing. It's not a bloody novel! I start composing a righteously indignant B.S. Johnson-style rejoinder in which I quote T.S. Eliot,
"Humankind cannot bear very much reality,"
and point out to them in no uncertain terms the artistic validity of what I'm doing, but really, what's the point? Writing, for them, is something that gets sold in books, and to me it's something more than that. So why waste the mental energy? Already disheartened, I read the next one.
Thank you for your submission to join Lightopia Writers' Colony. Unfortunately, we are unable to accept your application at the present time. Please understand that we cannot accept all submissions for membership, and on the first attempt, you are free to reapply after a 3-month period. This thread and your submission will be deleted shortly. With all good wishes, Lightopia Writers' Colony.
No problem. I'll just be sticking that banner of theirs I put up on the website somewhere the sun doesn't shine. And pillix to your effing colony. And so it goes on, a bitter, bitty day when nothing seems to click. I don't do any writing because I'm shattered by a week of trying to squeeze in being creative and thoughtful around gaps in the everyday routine at work and at home. The only time I get that's entirely my own is on the minibus with all the other fruit pickers, jotting down the day's efforts as I'm pitched up in the air, tossed around like a single-handed yachtsman by pothole and sleeping policeman alike. No wonder this thing is so fragmented. It's a wonder I can read my handwriting at all at times. Instead of working, I spend hours looking for an old demo tape I could swear I had in my hand 3 or 4 weeks ago, but now, can I find it anywhere? I'm starting to get that feeling you get when you know this just isn't going to be your day. So it's with trepidation that I head off to the Prisoner of War. Special screenings of Escape to Victory, Whist Drive and Finger Buffet every third Wednesday to watch the game. Unsurprisingly, and with grinding inevitability, it takes Liverpool a mere 5 minutes to score. Fabregas attempts to play the ball out from defence after a good passage of play from the home side that's already forced a full-stretch save from Manuel Almunia. Cesc's effort to cushion the ball with his thigh is too heavy, and he clips the toe of Alonso's boot just outside the box in his attempt to retrieve the runaway ball. Almunia calls for one more man in the wall to defend the resulting free kick, and Cesc duly obliges. But in his eagerness to charge down the ball, as Gerrard shapes to shoot, he leaves a gaping hole for Stevie G to aim at. His strike is so venomous, though, that you could almost imagine it cannonballing through regardless, Hanna-Barbera style, leaving a smouldering, acme football-sized hole in the mid-rift of the Arsenal defender who was foolish enough to have stood in its way before scorching a similar-shaped void into the net. It's just my luck. This usually quiet local, dotted with a handful of die-hard regulars who appear to have been rooted to the spot since the last time you were there several weeks ago, seems miraculously to have been chosen as this year's venue for the Liverpool Southern Supporters' annual dinner dance. That's the only explanation I can find for the sudden eruption of joy that surrounds me as the pub leaps in the air as one, expressing their fervour in a variety of South of Watford accents that run the gamut from plummy received pronunciation to estuary tang. Away from their adopted home, back up north in Liverpool, Gerard does one of those finger-running along the keyboard slides along the grass on his knees to the touchline in celebration before being mobbed by jubilant Reds. Here we go, you think. This is where it all comes crashing down. Liverpool seem well up for this game in the wake of their European defeat midweek. Gerard in particular is tackling ferociously, and there are several audible crunches as he, Carragher and Voronin go crashing in. The wolfish Sammy Herpia runs a lupine tongue around his lips as he leaves Adebayor pinioned to the ground, writhing around in an even more carnally tormented than usual Jens Lehmann warm-up routine. But this is no place for Lamsey, and miraculously the young Arsenal players hold their nerve. And then they start to play. Clichy, a preternaturally cool customer for one of so few years, as he has been so often this season, is the architect of many of these audacious, nonus shitters passages in which stout defence elides into attack through a sequence of calm and measured passes. For a lengthy spell in this first period, you could be forgiven the belief that the team with the one in the column beside their name is the one wearing white shirts and not red. Liverpool still managed to tee up Gerrard with another potent shot, which Almunia manages to claw over the bar, but Arsenal's pressing and passing is looking more likely to bear fruit. As Alex Ferguson looks on, blue-nosed and rather glum, from somewhere deep in the Anfield stands, the game resumes. It's frantic, passionate stuff. Liverpool managed to restrict Arsenal passing themselves into dangerous areas. And when Eboué, suddenly starting to look plausible in his new position as an attacking midfielder, tiptoes into the Liverpool box and sees a well-struck low shot cannon back off the upright, it really does seem to be turning into one of those days. This feeling has compound interest added to it when the rebound lands invitingly at the feet of the one player on the pitch any Arsenal fan would most like it to fall. Sadly, Cesc can't adjust quite quickly enough to get his reaction shot on target. I turn to H, who's joined me for the second half, and ask, how do Liverpool do it? They manage to do virtually nothing and win. With a quarter of an hour to play, I can't see Arsenal scoring. Wenger has made all the changes he can. Gilberto, Bentner and Walcott have been brought on as Arsenal chase the game. Walcott gets jeered by the Liverpool faithful every time he loses his footing on what seems a very slippy pitch. They get to jeer a lot. Gallas, leading by example, goes on a daring dribble that runs out of steam just inside the Liverpool box. I start to worry that the team has tired. Oh me, of little faith. Alex has kept toiling quietly away without too much drama until, eventually, like a master of mystery waiting for the perfect moment to apply a twist to the plot, he's where we want him to be, running at the Liverpool defence. The wily old Belarusian coyote decides that it's time for that old claw on the ball of wool trick again. He waits and waits and waits a little bit more, sensing something special in the air. Or maybe he can hear the galloping of Fabregas as he charges towards the box. Finally, Kleb puts an end to the suspense. He clips a ball beyond the Liverpool line and Fabregas is speedy Gonzalez, racing onto it to stab the ball just inside Reina's near post. This time it's Fab's turn to... on his knees towards the corner flag, in emulation of his hero Stevie G. He lingers there a second before punching an arm in the air at the Arsenal fans, who are dancing in delight in the Michael Thomas end. He and Alex have set us up for a fabulous finale. It's an end-to-end game in the last 10 minutes, and you feel both sides want to win the game right up until the final whistle blows. Gallus's despairing dive foils a Gerard shot from a tight angle, and Fabregas combines with Bentner to recreate Eboué's earlier efforts to dismantle the Liverpool goal. This time it's Fab's shot that strikes the woodwork. Bentner snatches at his shot when the ball bounces favourably in front of him, blasting over when he had time to take a touch and pick his spot. Fabregas runs away with his palms tapping his crown in agonised disbelief. For a while you share young Fabregas's frustration, but then there's enough purring from the pundits as it is. This draw has made a few people reconsider this young Arsenal side's credentials. How unbearable would they have been had we won? So there you go. Lessons learned. Never give up. Especially not on this young Arsenal side. Let's hope Sir Alex's nose is even bluer and his expression just as glum at the Emirates in just under a week. So it goes on. The daily battle between your consciousness and the competing clamour of the world of work. Sometimes you feel it's drowning you, but you must persist. You must prevail. Keep its fire burning, cherish it and nurture it, because in the end, it's all you've got. Wednesday, October the 31st, 2007. 1930. Saturday, 26th of April, 1930. FA Cup Final. Arsenal 2, Huddersfield Town 0.
In the Tower of London, large as life, the ghost of Anne Boleyn walks, they declare. Poor Anne Boleyn was once King Henry's wife, until he made the headsman bob her hair. Ah, yes, he did a wrong long years ago, and she comes up at night to tell him so, with her head tucked underneath her arm. She walks the bloody tower with her head tucked underneath her arm at the midnight hour. She comes to haunt King Henry, she means giving him what for. Gadzook, she's going to tell him off for having spilt her gore. And just in case the headsman wants to give her an encore, she has her head tucked underneath her arm, with her head tucked underneath her arm. She walks the bloody tower with her head tucked underneath her arm at the midnight hour. Along the drafty corridors for miles and miles she goes. She often catches cold, poor thing, it's cold there when it blows. And it's awfully awkward for the Queen to have to blow her nose, with her head tucked underneath her arm. Sometimes gay King Henry gives a spread for all his gals and pals, a ghostly crew. The headsman carves the joint and cuts the bread. Then in comes Anne Boleyn to queer the do. She holds her head up with a wild war whoop, and Henry cries, don't drop it in the soup, with her head tucked underneath her arm. She walks the bloody tower with her head tucked tucked underneath her arm at the midnight hour. The sentries think that it's a football that she carries in, and when they've had a few, they shout, "Is Arsenal going to win?" They think it's Alec James instead of poor old Anne Boleyn, with her head tucked underneath her arm, with her head tucked underneath her arm. She walks the bloody tower with the head tucked underneath her arm at the midnight hour. One night she caught King Henry, he was in the canteen bar. Said he, "Are you Jane Seymour, Anne Boleyn, or Catherine Parr? For how the sweet San Ferian do I know who you are? With your head tucked underneath your arm."
She glides through misty blue, wisps of color play around a bulbous prow. No akak this time as we survey the hazy maquette of tidy suburbs down below. Then out of nowhere, Wembley Stadium looms. Lime sherbet set like a rhinestone in plastic and concrete. The oval rim, quite dull and grey, besides the glinting jewel. But somehow, the whole remaining mystical. I squeeze my father's hand as we peer down through the glass that stands between us and a free fall through the air outside. We're safe here in this chrome-lined basket, clinging like a barnacle to the underside of our blau gas-bloated veil of a balloon. 92,488 watched the 1930 FA Cup final. But few could say they saw it quite like me. We came in peace this time, but still the traces come. Flat caps, infinitesimally tiny dots tossed up towards us by a few among the 90 or so thousand other ever so slightly larger dots, a dark hull looms above. 20 or so ants scamper about the green stone kernel of the ring below our grey speech bubble craft. They hug the white rectangles cut diagonally across in such strange, beguiling stop-start patterns. Our engine's hum blots out the roars that accompanies all their frantic scurrying and scuttling. When we are both a little old, my father will sit me down upon his knee and reminisce about that day and our exalted bird's eye view. He tells me details of the game we saw, provides a concrete casing of facts and figures to support the emerald of memory. Il crooner plodding comic dirge of a song. And when they've had a few, they shout, is Arsenal going to win? They think it's Alec James instead of Paul Dan Boleyn. I sing the same song to Hannah when she's young. She fidgets on my knee. My accent turning W's into V's and TH's into S's. Then when I've sung my song, I tell her how the pilot dipped the nose of the famous airship, the Graf Zeppelin, into a stiff Germanic curtsy before King George V. And Hannah has come to visit me now to fit some earphones to her father's wisp-haired head. Another set of wires to join the myriad tubes and cables all around me. I hear that chocolate gobbling voice once more, preserved somehow amid the fizzing of the shellac, somehow squeezed into a fist-sized gizmo. With the head talks underneath the arm, I mouth and nod along once more and beam back at her as the day comes back entire. She'll see me smile, Vilhanna, see her father's tired fingers dance a sprightly jig upon the sleeve of my pajamas. She'll look back and realize that it's not her who's given something precious to her dad, but her papa who's secreted something wonderful and special for the daughter that he loves. A present left for her to find and to unwrap in her own time. For what better gift is there than a smile to leave behind me as I sail into the blue?
Tuesday, the 6th of November, 2007. Arsenal 2, Manchester United 2. Billions watched. It had to happen sooner or later, I suppose. The first real stumble of the season. Not the team. The two draws that have so rudely interrupted our fine sequence of wins in all competitions were both against quality opposition, so no disgrace there. I'm talking about the book. The writing is the problem at the moment, not the team. 3 days have elapsed since William Gallas' late goal earned us a point against the reigning champions, and I have been, until now, unable to get any words to come out at all. I've been stuck, sat before the white sheet with nothing coming, just blankness and a fuzzing of the brain. With the away game in Prague looming, I forced myself to start writing, just to see what comes, before the whole lumbering juggernaut that is the road to Moscow judders to a halt, with barely a quarter of a season played. Moscow seems a long way away right now. Like a billion other people, I watched the Man U game on television. Maybe that's the problem. After all, most of those billions of souls, we'll assume that most of them had or now have some interest in the broader game of football, might reasonably be expected to comprise the bulk of my prospective readership around the globe. If they've seen the game, as I did,
via the mediating filter of satellite TV. What could I possibly tell them about Arsenal versus Manchester United that they don't already know? Why should my experience of the game be worth reading about when they already have a perfectly good one of their own? So we all sat there, or slouched, or stood, or sprawled across the floor, or the sofa, or reclined in an office chair, and gawped at the screen on the wall of the dilapidated pub, or at our laptop in Silesia, or a projector in Saigon. The vagaries of the shapes and dimensions of the screens no more significant than those of different-sized bowls into which uniformly apportioned slops of identical gruel might have been doled on a collectivised farm. Because even with the death of communism, we can still be made to endure a similar communal impoverishment of the consciousness. Oh, sure, you can choose your camera angles and listen to the commentary team in Swahili, but it's still nothing at all like being there is watching Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV. It's better than some dandruff-ridden 70s satellite transmission of a game from the Soviet bloc, but in the end you just endure a different kind of tyranny, one of pizzazz and hyperbole, not that of static, snow and a rolling drum picture. I suppose this is the kind of problem you can expect, though, when you write about the popular or common experience in the age of the globalised media. We all think we know more than those who play the game, or the men who pick the teams. The stodgy-faced Man United fan sat in the corner rails at the screen. You have to do better than that! As Ryan Giggs' instinctive reaction shot at the end of a cross he's not expecting to reach him pings just wide. It's as if there's a suggestion that Giggs might somehow prefer to miss than score a goal. We all know, or think we know, the game inside out. A global panel of pundits and experts, we stretch from Beijing to Nova Scotia. So what can I say that might add anything at all of worth to our understanding the beautiful game? I could tell you about the soft Irish-flavoured lilt of the home-shirted Liverpool fan stood beside me at the bar, I suppose. I could try to describe the way his spectacles did that goldfish bowl thing that makes the wearer look like Joe 90 or one of the Tracy brothers from Gerry Anderson's Thunderbirds. Or I could pass on to the gentle reader that this lad's seat was in the end where all the goals were scored in Istanbul that night in May 2005, when Liverpool came back from 3 goals behind to snatch the European Cup from AC Milan. Or I could tell you how we hugged, two perfect strangers united in antipathy towards Man United, when William Gallas' late goal levelled the scores. But then a billion others would have watched as we did, their eyes like ours refusing to believe the referee's unarguable point back to the centre circle, only losing any doubt the goal was good once we had borne witness to the gentle dropping down of that levelling two in place of that sad loser's one, clicking over as slowly as the counter of a wristwatch on the Sky scoreboard. Gallas's goal thus legitimised, only then could our festivities begin. But then you will all have your own stories, the billion others of you out there who either leapt for joy as we did or hung your head in despair at that late 2-point stealing goal. Or maybe you were a neutral, just happy to enjoy the game. Perhaps it's you I'm writing for, the uncommitted, the one who likes but does not love. Applauds rather than cheers. But how do you describe in words a passion to those who do not share it? How could I describe that joyous leap, the massed rank of fists raised up towards the ceiling, pink-faced, our hearts pounding, laughing at the outrageousness of it all? Substitute the elation they felt and the doom in our hearts when Ronaldo scored their second, and perhaps that's why a game we only drew had more of the feeling you'd expect from a victory. Or maybe I'm writing for someone else entirely, someone not yet born, someone who may never know a game called football, who may wonder what they used to do in that crumbling wreck called Emirates. Someone to whom our loafers and trainers, polo shirts and tracky bottoms will seem as antiquated as a Roman tunic or a gladiator's sandals, or that once great Colosseum do to us. You write for time, I suppose, to tell the billions yet to come what it was like to be among the billions who were once here.